Good morning. It's St. Patrick's Day and green is on our agenda, specifically the green from Social Security and whether there's a difference in the way Democratic presidential candidates view that entitlement. And later we'll have a look at the proposed hike in the fuel tax, just when you may have gotten used to a little relief at the pump. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Aspiring writers can get discouraged by the hurdles they have to jump to get published. Local author-illustrator Kirsten Carlson has some advice. And the Honolulu Museum of Art puts the focus on design that could only have come from Hawaii.
That's the conversation for this Thursday, March 17th. It all starts right after the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
Good morning to you and happy St. Patrick's Day.
I cannot go unsaid, right?
And you made sure that was so.
That's right. That's right.
Well, thanks very much for that. And we're hoping that you're having a good St. Patrick's Day, at least the start of it, too.
That's right.
Now, Democratic Party members affiliated with a candidate of their choice will make it expressly clear at the presidential preference poll, the Democratic Caucus, a week from this Saturday. And while supporters for Senator Sanders or Secretary Clinton like to tout differences, in certain issues, the candidates sound alike. Take an issue that for long-lived people in Hawaii is truly an issue, Social Security and Medicare. Both candidates say they will defend the program, but it's in the how they might do it that we asked Dan Adcock to weigh in. He's the Director of Government Relations and Policy for the National Committee to Preserve Medicare and Social Security. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann and Chris.
Good to have you here. As you are looking at the candidates, and you see that there may be some real similarities when you hear both Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders say that they will defend Social Security and Medicare, is there really truly a difference in the approach that each takes?
Well, I think that's kind of been a moving target. But first, let me say, first off, my organization, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, I just want to make it clear that we don't endorse on the presidential level, but obviously we have a great interest in what positions the candidates take on Social Security and Medicare. I think both, we've worked with Senator Sanders for a long time. He's been probably the chief advocate of our best advocate in the United States Senate. And obviously, we worked with Secretary Clinton when she was a senator. I think, over the years, they both have been great on our issues. Senator Sanders has been very clear about, where he is on Social Security issues, that he sees that the retirement crisis that we're facing, where middle-class workers have suffered under stagnant wages for nearly three decades and haven't really had the capacity to save enough in retirement, that Social Security is really becoming more important. So that's why, he supports not only ensuring that the program is solvent for the long haul, but includes some across-the-board benefit reductions. And Secretary Clinton is, over time, in fact, made it very unequivocal at her victory speech earlier this week after she won in Ohio and elsewhere, she would oppose cuts to Social Security and would also improve benefits, which we were very happy to see. But the tack that she takes is a little bit different in that she wants to emphasize improving the program for people that need it the most, and she specifically targeted women through a couple proposals that would benefit them, and we certainly agree with that. We've had a campaign called Eleanor's Hope.
Right. I want to just stop you right there because I want to talk to you a little bit about this. But, with both of them saying that they want to protect it and they want to expand it, you've just made the point for Secretary Clinton looks a little different than it does for Bernie Sanders. But how do you expect that that may be truly a defining line for a lot of people who are, for example, in our state, really dependent upon Social Security when they hear, you know, both candidates say, yeah, this is very important. We have to protect and expand it.
Right. Well, again, I think that it's, you know, they're coming at it from different directions. I think that slightly different directions, I should underscore. Again, you know, I think that he sees that the program needs to be improved for everybody by doing things like a $65 a month increase in benefits for everybody and to also have a more fair adjustment of inflation in the form of a cost of living adjustment. But he also specifically targets lower-income Social Security beneficiaries, so they have a benefit that is least equals 125% of poverty, where she supports proposals that would provide a caregiver credit, Social Security caregiver credit, to make up for the lost time that women disproportionately spend out of the workforce to care for kids and elderly parents, but also would improve survivor benefits so to ensure that they equal 75% of household income before their spouse passed away. I don't, you know, from our perspective, these are both great ways to address the program, to address, you know, the adequacy of the benefits that we really think is really going to become more important over time, especially because of the fact that people are going to have less income in retirement.
Dan Adcock, do you also see that each, you know, candidate's position is truly economically feasible?
Yeah, we do. And certainly the American people have supported through all the polls that we've seen over the years, including one that the National Academy of Social Insurance did not that long ago, that people this program is overwhelmingly popular both among Republicans and Democrats. And the polling has showed that not only, you know, do they support the program, but they would be willing to pay a little bit more in the form of payroll taxes to ensure that not only these programs continue for themselves and for their grandkids, but also to ensure that you have money left over to improve benefits. And so, you know, I think that through raising the cap on payroll taxes, right now you pay payroll taxes on the first $118,500. We just think it's a matter of fairness that everybody should have to pay 6.2% of their income towards financing the program. So I think there's definitely pathways to make changes like that to ensure that the program continues to provide retirement security to millions of people across the country.
But didn't Secretary Clinton say that she didn't want to raise taxes on anyone?
Well, she does. What she said is that she doesn't want to raise taxes on the middle class. And so, and I think that actually Senator Sanders is coming from a very similar position. He's introduced legislation that would keep the payroll tax cap at $118,500. You pay 6.2% on that income, but from $118,500 to $250,000, there would be no tax. But above $250,000, you would be paying 6.2% on any income earned above that amount. And so that way, you have a gap in there that protects people who, you know, by some definition, some people would consider middle class. And so that way you don't raise taxes on those particular individuals within that gap of $118,500 to $250,000.
And to be very clear, any attempt to do any sort of privatization you think is off the table?
Yes, certainly with both Senator Sanders and Secretary Clinton, they've made it, they're unequivocal about opposing privatization, and we support that position. We think that, you know, we successfully fought President George W. Bush's proposal to privatize the program. We think it would have been a disaster just in transitional costs, and it would have robbed the program of money that it needed to pay benefits through the traditional program.
Dan Adcock, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dan Adcock is the Director of Government Relations and Policy for the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He is a former legislative director at the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:13. Coming up, Hawaii as design in a major exhibition at the Honolulu Museum of Art. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, olehua on ihau ukaua uahu umulokai ulana umau ukaho olave uhavai.
In honor of St. Patrick's Day, today's backyard quiz centers around a longtime Hawaii retail chain founded in 1857. The store's founder and namesake came to the Kingdom of Hawaii from Ireland at a time when Honolulu was becoming the center of commerce in the islands. From humble beginnings at the corner of Baratania and Mauna Kea streets, this chain of retail stores gradually grew to become an iconic local brand in Hawaii, with locations on Oahu, Maui, Kauai, Hawaii Island, even Guam. The founder's twin sons went on to become territorial senator and city planning commissioner, respectively. Sadly, in 2002, the chain shuttered its doors, closed its remaining 13 locations, and went out of business. On this St. Patrick's Day, we'd like you to name this retail chain. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 with the right answer and no blarney, and you'll get the HPR t-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Norman Berg from Vita Food for Life. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join The Conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Most of us don't think much about the way design seeps into our consciousness, but we're likely to be more affected by the shapes, colors, and images we see around us than we realize. In Hawaii, hints of oceans and mountains can be found in the arc of buildings and in the font on an advertisement. The Honolulu Museum of Art is taking a detailed look at the world of design that's specific to our islands in a new exhibition called Hawaii in Design, a look at 10 island designers from across the state. Haloa Johnson is the Curator of Arts of Hawaii at the museum. She joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. Obviously, when you put together a show like this, you sort of look for what the defining elements are. How did you embark on that search?
It really started with an article I read by John Charlo, who described Hawaiian aesthetics as a distillation of the natural world into form, function, and pattern, and I'm paraphrasing here. Mm-hmm. But it made me think about those qualities as a design principle in Hawaii, mm-hmm. the way that artists and designers are responding to the world around them, and the way that they then shape how people understand or perceive Hawaii through their interpretation of Hawaii's environment.
You know, if I were to sort of free associate to this idea, I would think probably of flowing shapes, for example, things that evoke the ocean, even the way mountains play against the horizon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's the designers and artists who are in the show. There are some who are graphic artists, furniture designers, fashion designers. Mm-hmm. They all kind of have their own interpretation or translation of different elements within Hawaii. And so, for example, Sig Zane is in the exhibition, and they don't have the flowing lines, but what they do have is a highly geometric pattern that is in keeping with kapa motifs. Uh-huh. And they're interpreting the idea of kuhao, which is rain on a clear day.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have an image that is 4 feet by, I think, about 15 feet, mounted against the wall, and it's a white piece against a white wall, and it's the idea of a pattern emerging unexpectedly, the way that rain on a clear day would emerge unexpectedly
uh-huh.
from the sky.
So it isn't, doesn't follow what necessarily might be a stereotyped idea of what you'd see, yeah?
That's right. It's these artists and designers' way of recontextualizing ideas that have been a part of Hawaii's historical trajectory for a long time.
When you mention things like design of clothing and furniture, obviously function comes into, and the way we live now, you know, the fact that we are outside, that we have warm weather, warm air, that automatically affects practical things like clothing and furniture, yeah?
That's right. And there's, in the case of Sig Zane, you know, they use the aloha shirt to circulate ancient Hawaiian references and mm-hmm. symbols. But the aloha shirt is not necessary for them, which is why their brand, as they build it now, is being recontextualized into these different environments. There's another designer, though, in the exhibition, Salvage Public. They're a very young brand, that features three young designers. I think they all graduated from Kamehameha schools. And they really built their brand out of T-shirts. And they tailored their T-shirts for a slimmer fit, slightly longer hemline. They changed the sleeves a little bit. And it was a way of updating a very casual look. And instead of putting the quintessential or iconic image of Leahi, Diamond Head, they use specifically local references. So the T-shirt will say Walrat or Sansuzi. And it requires a local association in order to make sense of the text that they use.
Uh-huh.
And it's their way of not conforming to the expected or stereotypical depictions of their experience here in Hawaii. And yet, they're super popular. They've got a big following in Japan, great following here in Hawaii.
And just the very act of not conforming, that's all part of the process, too, because if you're sort of doing what previous generations have already done, you're not doing that much, right?
It's right, and I think the exhibition in general is not rooted in nostalgia. It's not a historical analysis of design in Hawaii. It's really a presentation of 10 contemporary designers, and most of the work in the exhibition actually looks to what the designers are embarking on in the future. So it's not necessarily presenting work that they've done historically.
Yeah.
They produce new work for this exhibition, and it pushes them toward the kind of projects that they are actually gearing toward.
Well, what you're making me think of, Aloha, is that a lot of the images that I might associate with Hawaii design are kind of on their way out. They're not going to be as prevalent in 20 years. It's inevitable that they wouldn't be, right?
That's right. That's right. And I think it's exciting to have, you know, so many young designers. Most of them are, I think they're all under 50. Most of them are under 40.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very active, and they're rethinking the kind of images that they grew up with.
Yeah.
And they're trying to translate their experience into something that is meaningful and that is relevant. And it's exciting to see the kind of creativity and the way that they brainstorm, the way that they problem solve. It was a wonderful exhibition to curate.
You know, we were talking earlier about Hawaii architecture and how it reflects the fact that we have the opportunity to be outside
mm-hmm.
a lot. And that's just an example of environment affecting design, right?
That's right. That's right. And Hawaii has, the people of Hawaii, for a very, very long time, have had almost a seamless relationship with the land and the ocean around them. It, mm-hmm. it was a part of how Hawaiians functioned, was living at one, merging oneself with the environment. And so looking at how these designers are building on that tradition and how living in a virtual reality and an urban environment is now a part of it's naturalized into our experience.
Yeah.
And so looking at how these designers are maintaining this, what I'm calling a Hawaiian design principle of, you know, responding to the world around oneself and distilling it into tangible forms. It's really interesting to see how that evolves as Hawaii evolves.
Well, inevitably, contemporary life, urban life, encourages a disconnect with the land and the ocean that I would think that Hawaii designers were at pains to hang on to.
And you see them actually trying to figure out how to make sense of many of them who were raised in an urban environment or, you know, I mean, suburban environment at
sure.
the very least. And how do they make sense of their time in the ocean and their relationship
yeah.
to the natural world? But there's an artist named Joseph Pa'ahana. He's a graphic artist in the exhibition, and he created a video, and he has a very urban aesthetic. He grew up on Maui but lives here in Honolulu, and he created a video that looks at the way humans try to relate to the origins of life through transcending stages of consciousness. But he does this in like almost a skateboard vernacular, because that's what he designs graphics for, skateboards. And so he has this really incredibly unique approach to commenting on, you know, this allegorical narrative about, you know, transcending stages of consciousness, and then also trying to tap into like the human condition and the need for humans to understand the origins of life.
It would seem that there's a lot that we'd be beyond what one would expect in this show. So I'll look forward to seeing it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Leihalo, for coming in. Haloa Johnston is the curator of Arts of Hawaii at the Honolulu Museum of Art. And the Hawaiian Design exhibit opens today and runs until March 12th of next year.
Federal Appeals Court Judge Merrick Garland wants a promotion.
For me, there could be no higher public service than serving as a member of the United States Supreme Court.
President Obama's nominee heads to Capitol Hill to lobby senators, but will Republicans open their doors? That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, following The Conversation.
You love HPR. You listen all the time. You're a true radiophile. Mahalo for recent gifts that came to us from Diane Edminster of Mountain View, Louise Wynn of Honaunau, and Christine Richardson of Hawaii. Thank you all for those gifts. Early initiative on your part can mean that we have fewer fundraising interruptions in the future. If you'd like to be a part of that effort, call us at 955-8821 during business hours, or you can give online at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks so much.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Theater Center, presenting the Midtown Men, four original cast members of Broadway's Jersey Boys singing hit songs of the 60s, this Saturday and Sunday. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
Naiopuni says it now won't pursue a ratification vote on a Native Hawaiian constitution. And while it believes that the AHA participants themselves should take the lead in that effort, well, that's already happening. So does that do away with the problems that have buffeted Naiopuni? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so we heard from them yesterday that they're going to step back and let leadership lead. But is this backpedaling on the part of Naiopuni?
Well, there's certainly a range of opinions about what's going on. But the organization itself says, yeah, we've done our job. We were tasked with bringing folks together for an AHA, for a convention. And lo and behold, they produced a constitution. But Naiopuni says it's no longer going to be involved. There's some question whether they actually have the funds. There's only about $100,000 left in the money that they got indirectly from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. So certainly financial considerations are being considered. Oh, there's a repeat of two words there. Sorry about that. But I think that the point going forward, what I'm hearing from the AHA participants themselves is we expected this to happen. When the AHA was concluding, they had the sense that Naiopuni was going to be taking themselves out, and they feel that they're already well on their way to educating people about this constitution, why it's so important, and their fundraising. They've got a crowdsourced Kickstarter, if you will, website up there, and they say they've already raised $5,000 to help get the word out and set up a ratification vote, perhaps by the end of this year.
But what does that do for example, the Aloha Aina folks?
Well, that's, of course, the other AHA, if you will. They're the ones that feel Naiopuni is an agent of the state, that it's not really democratic, that there's really not a lot of Hawaiians involved. Remember, only 80 or 90 Hawaiians actually participated, agreed to the constitution that the AHA put together, the Na'iapuni AHA. But this other organization feels that they're doing their own. They don't want federal recognition. They want true independence or sovereignty. And they are proceeding with their own AHA around the state, various gatherings. And they feel that that is the true path towards independence.
And what about the overlay of the Grassroots Institute of Hawaii lawsuit? We're still waiting for that. Yeah. And some might say, well, does that make this moot at this point?
That's what the attorney for Na'iapuni, Bill Meheula, says. It is moot because we're not going to have a ratification vote. And remember, they didn't have an election either because Grassroots challenged them in court. And so that's what they feel. Talking to Grassroots, they feel that there's still a case at issue here. It is before the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we'll see. But if Na'iapuni is no longer in the business of nation building, why should there be a lawsuit? So we'll see what the Ninth Circuit rules on that, whether they side with Na'iapuni or the Grassroots Institute.
All right, which seems like a good place to end. Have a good St. Patrick's Day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
And every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair.
Good morning. At 8:29, you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook. You can reach us at Hawaii Public Radio in several different ways. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217. We're also on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, the long path from inspiration to publication for the creators of children's books. But first, the news from Deutsche Welle.
Support for The Conversation comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square, looking at what's alive and what ain't at the legislature.
You bet. It's what we do every year. We come back right at the time of crossover. Neil Milner will be here. Colin Moore will be here. And they've been putting together their lists of what made it, what didn't, and what that means as we seem to see this characterization of this legislative session being revealed in what's going forward and what didn't, at least at this point.
Yeah, at crossover, bills go from one chamber to the other and inevitably meet with a different response and different heard by different committees and get revised, right?
Right, and that includes, the budget, too. The budget went over from the House. We'll see what happens. It's going to be several weeks before we see what's going to go on in the Senate. And obviously, when it comes down to money, that's where we really see what we're willing to do and what we're not.
That's right. But in the rhythms of the legislative session, this is when things really get interestinger.
Yeah, I like the way you put that. We're going to talk about how it's becoming more interesting later on tonight. And I hope you'll plan to join us at 5 o'clock with me, Milner, and Moore right here on HPR2.
Hi, good morning. I'm Jason Hoffman from Mensa Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Just when you might be feeling a little relief at the pump, a Senate bill to hike the fuel tax, among other things, has crossed over to the House. The rationale is to shore up the state highway fund, and while few would dispute the need for better road maintenance, perhaps, the Building Industry Association of Hawaii says, well, it's just not that simple. Gladys Morone is the CEO and chief lobbyist for the BIA, and she joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, we always talk about our roads, both, you know, that those are maintained by the city as well as the state highways. But looking at this bill, you had a number of issues with it and say that it's just not a matter of trying to get more money thrown at the state highway fund. Why?
Well, we believe that, of course, the need to fund the state highway fund is important for road maintenance and repairs, which go towards fuel efficiency and driver safety. But we feel that the Department of Transportation should be more accountable to as to how those funds are being used.
You seem to be talking not about what is generated in-state, but also the backlog of the state's use of federal funds that it already has.
Yes, and I understand that the $600 million or so in federal funding that in the backlog have already been accounted for, so they may not be necessarily used for road repair and maintenance. But our concern is that the management of those funds, having gotten those, you know, that backlog, and the delivery of projects is what's been concerning to us with regards to taxing residents more.
So what would you like to see happen then? Because certainly roads are very important to the building industry.
Absolutely. I think one of the issues that we brought up in our concerns was, I guess, the move to raise the tax on fuel probably compensates with the increase in the EV and hybrid vehicles, which consume no or very little gas. But maybe one suggestion would be to bring the cost of that up to par by maybe increasing registration fees for those types of vehicles. It might not be popular, but it would at least be more equitable.
Okay, so seeing that that might be a potential way of trying to offset, but surely we don't have enough of those vehicles to make up, you know, $75 million.
Right, and I think maybe, you know, with the move towards more energy efficiency, maybe the fuel tax is not the most sustainable today. If the department and the legislature sees that, you know, road maintenance and repairs is a priority, and I know that the department is supposed to be self-sustaining, maybe general funds might be used to do that.
It sounds like you have more questions than you have answers.
We do. We do have a lot of questions. You know, there's reports out there that show how we spend $90,000 per mile on administrative costs. So there's a lot of room for improvement for inefficiency and project planning and prioritizing and how does that all work. And I think we believe that the public may not be so put off with paying a little more if they knew exactly what that money was going towards.
And perhaps if they saw it being used in a timely fashion.
Absolutely.
You have some examples of that not necessarily being used in a timely fashion. You've, in your testimony, talked about Kapolei, and that's the fact that there hasn't, in your opinion, been enough support to the growth of it in terms of how roads have been maintained and created.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we should learn from our past. Kapolei was identified as the second city where the growth was going to happen, yet the roads were, in our opinion, inadequate to support that growth. And so we, moving into the future, growth is projected to be around the future train stations. And so perhaps state roads feeding into those stations should be a priority with regards to how the funding is used.
As you look at where the bill is now, and we should say that On the 10th, it was referred to the House Finance and Transportation Committees. But as of looking at it this morning, there's no hearing date. Do you take that as being a little bit of evidence that maybe they're weighing some of what this testimony really has been showing since the last month?
Perhaps, and I think it's critical that they really look into it and see what the repercussions would be and whether or not they could have other solutions rather than increasing the vehicle-related taxes.
All right. Well, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, Beth Ann.
Gladys Moroney is the CEO and chief lobbyist for the Building Industry Association of Hawaii. Senate Bill 2938 would increase registration fees and the fuel tax, among other things. It has already passed its first reading in the House and is with the Finance and Transportation Committees.
Prize-winning author Rick Atkinson says compromise was key in the founding era.
That's what the founding fathers were all about. Virtually everything that they do in the cause of forming the new republic is an act of compromise.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason, tonight at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for The Conversation comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
And now we're getting back to our backyard quiz. We wanted to know the name of a Hawaii retail chain founded in the 19th century by an Irish immigrant. In 1857, a ship's carpenter came to Honolulu from Ireland with his wife and four children. The original store location on Baratania Street sold household items, ship stores, jewelry, clothing, and other everyday items. The store catered to wealthy foreigners and served as a haberdashery for the Hawaiian royal court. Throughout the 20th century, the chain evolved to include large department stores for local residents and small shops geared toward visitors. Eventually, the store was established in iconic locations, including Ala Moana Center and the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. But in 2002, the retail chain McInerney announced that it would close all of its locations across Hawaii. Perhaps you might remember shopping there just a few years ago, but actually, it was well over a decade. That's the answer to our quiz, McInerney, and it's now 8:44. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. And I just found out we just had a winner, somebody
Lynn
who knew that.
Lynn Fragus of Kamauela was provided with some solace from our backyard quiz. She says it's raining, and she's chilling by the fireplace. Congratulations, Lynn. You'll get your T-shirt.
That's a March vision we don't usually hear, chilling
right
by the fireplace. Anyway, thanks very much for joining and playing with us today.
If you get an unexpected bill, a big one, say $1,000, could you pay it?
With our members, even with myself, I mean, that's a huge, that's a big amount. If they work paycheck to paycheck as is, it's a difficult thing.
I'm Kai Rizdal. More stories from the Marketplace Edison Research Poll next time.
This evening at 6, following Town Square.
Hi, good morning. I'm Ethel Villalobos from the UH Honeybee Project. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
As every parent knows, Communicating with children is a two-way street, giving back as many rewards as it provides. For children's books authors and illustrators, those rewards can be multiplied many times over if their work can reach a wide audience. But that requires a publisher and probably an agent. It also requires that the work be ready to present. Kirsten Carlson is a children's book author and illustrator who'll be one of the featured speakers at this weekend's 2016 Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators Hawaii Conference and Workshop, Smooth Sailing in the Sea of Children's Book Publishing. She's ready to help, and she's on the line this morning. Good morning, Kirsten.
Hi, good morning, Chris.
You know, I was looking at some of your work, and I was thinking that you can't really have a wilder imagination than children, so it can be very liberating to produce works for them, yeah?
That is absolutely correct. I actually am still a kid at heart, so I just channel that inner child whenever I create a story.
Makes sense. And it must be fun and kind of liberating as well, yeah?
It is liberating because when you're a child and when you're in that childlike state, you become very playful. I absolutely love it.
Well, most artists are really trying to get to that place where they were when they were six, right? In so many ways, that kind of unfettered imagination.
Yes, but we have the skill set of a grown-up, so it's actually a wonderful thing to access the childlike qualities, but mm-hmm. be able to have the skills of a grown-up.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does that translate into something that gets published and read by lots of kids and reaches a wide audience? There's a lot of steps from one to the other, isn't there?
My gosh, that's an excellent, excellent question. It is the crux of children's book publishing, actually, and the road is never a straight one. So it takes sometimes months to years to get a book published, but it's always really rewarding when you're sitting in a room with children and they are actually absorbed in your book, and you see the smiles on their faces.
Sure. Well, that would be the reward. But it's well. What was the process like for you?
Well, the process for me was I came at children's books from science. So I was a scientist, and I went into scientific illustration, and I decided children's books were just another canvas for me to communicate and tell stories about nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I joined the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators and went to a conference, and that's how I actually met my first publisher.
Which is tells you of the value of such conferences, right? Because obviously publishers are looking for good books to publish as well. It's not just the author that needs the publisher. It's a two-way street.
It is definitely a two-way street, and publishing professionals go to those conferences specifically looking for new talent, for new voice.
One of the things that I think you've brought to your work, Kirsten, is, as you say, you're a scientific illustrator, so your frogs, your toads really look like toads, don't they? They look the way toads.
I'm glad you say that. Yes.
Yeah.
Why? Yes, they do, Chris. They look like toads.
They look like.
I'm so happy.
But you know, they're not fanciful toads. They're any toad would recognize them as one of their own, right?
Correct. Correct.
But you have that thing that I would think that this is sort of the extra thing of that an illustrator brings is, it's one thing to draw an otter. It's another to draw an otter with a certain facial expression that evokes a mood. That's the trick, isn't it?
It is. You actually just nailed it on the head. In children's book illustrations, you actually are illustrating something with a narrative so that when the viewer is looking at the image, they are asking the question, what is going to happen next? And usually there's emotion attached to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is where the sort of the unfettered imagination comes in. I've got a picture in front of me of an octopus serving tea to a horseshoe crab and a snail, unnamed creatures watching from the weeds around there, but the kind of thing that it's sort of nature plus, yeah?
Yeah, that story is a fun one. I wanted to tell the story of what it was like to be invited to tea, from an octopus. And I hope when you see that image, that you ask yourself, what is going to happen next?
Well, when an octopus serves tea, they have the advantage of being able to serve all their guests at once, right? Because they have every arm is doing something.
Yeah, in the illustration that you're talking about that I created, there's actually some arms that are hidden from view because he only has three guests, but he has eight arms.
Yeah.
So that's part of the story, is to peek around and see what the other arms are up to.
Yeah, they're sort of groping around underneath the table, probably keeping the octopus from falling over. But at the same time, you have that thing of sort of creating, you know, did that start with the situation? Did that start with the picture? What led to an image like this?
Oh, that's another really awesome question. The way this started was the song that Ringo Starr has called
Octopus's
Garden.
Sure, yeah.
And I, with my science background, wanted to do something that combined a little bit of fact, and I wanted to bring in the whimsical. So even though I didn't really do the song at all in my image, listening to that song made me realize that I could take some of the animals I know are eaten by octopus and put them in a tea party format. And are you familiar with the story The Spider and the Fly?
Well, I think so.
It's an older story. It's kind of a dark story that is written in rhyme. And the reason this artwork ended up the way it was, it started because of Ringo Starr's song, but it ended because of The Spider and the Fly, which is a story that I used to hear a lot growing up. And I was fascinated with telling the darker tale of what happens when you're invited to a tea party with an octopus.
So this does put a sort of a sinister take on the whole thing, because so the party guests are kind of being set up by the octopus for later devouring, is now what you're telling me, huh?
Well, yeah, I don't use the word sinister. For me, it's dark, and I wanted to play around with it and make the reader wonder what happened next. So depending on your point of view,
there you go.
You actually get to go different directions. I actually like the way you were interpreting the illustration earlier, too.
Well, you see, it should be open to some interpretation, but I think you've hit on something really important, Kirsten, was that the whole idea of waiting for what happens next makes it a part of a narrative as opposed to a static image, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
So that would seem to be something that that would be an advice you could give to authors and illustrators of children's books, yeah? Make it, keep that story moving forward with every line, every illustration.
Correct. Yes, I would totally agree with that. And also, when you're planning out the story, think in terms of visuals as you plan it.
Sure. Do you have a story idea? Before you complete a book, do you know how it's going to end, or does that sort of happen while you're in the process?
For me, I often see two or three images of a story. For example, the octopus image you're talking about, I actually don't know what the whole story is yet. I haven't developed it completely. That's one image. But typically, when I start working on the illustrations, a story will kind of evolve. And then the part that is the most challenging for me personally is when I put words and pictures together as an author-illustrator and making sure that the words tell a story and the pictures also tell a story, and that they're not telling exactly the same story, that each one moves the story forward in its own way.
They need to supplement each other. You can't just show a tree and say, this is a tree, right? You can already figure that out.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks so much, Kirsten. It's good to talk to you.
You're welcome.
Kirsten Carlson is a children's book author and illustrator. She'll be one of the featured speakers at this weekend's 2016 Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators Hawaii Conference and Workshop, Smooth Sailing in the Sea of Children's Book Publishing. It's at the William S. Richardson Law School at UH Manoa, and you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
We were born before the wind, far so younger than the sun. Yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sailed into the mystic.
Aloha, I'm Derek Malama, and on the next Kanikapila Sunday, you'll hear music from the latest releases by Nathan Aviel, Mauna Lua, Patrick Lendeza, Natalie Aikomau, the duo Meleuhane, Sean Na'awau, and Kavika Kahiapo, plus the Kanikapila Sunday Classic. Please join me for Kanikapila Sunday from 1 to 4 p.m.
Beth Ann, Kirsten Carlson was describing the pleasure of reading one of her children's books to a group of kids and getting that response. And that kind of says it all about what the rewards would be of being a children's book author.
And also a parent.
Of a parent, yeah.
Who loves to read, and a child who loves to be read to, and, yeah. And few are those who don't. It's watching how children's books have changed in the past 10, 20 years, and seeing some of the different subject matter, and sometimes, the books getting a lot more real and coming at it from a kid's perspective as opposed to a nice story being told to children.
Right.
That's been rather rewarding to see that, and maybe a lot of kids feel that way too.
I think it'd be fun to create one.
Ooh, another vocation for you.
That's right.
Or avocation, at least. That's our show for this St. Patrick's Day. We're going to be back with you tomorrow for an Aloha Friday. We're going to do a check-in with Mayor Kirk Caldwell. We're also going to talk about the FCC's proposed privacy rules with Katarina Kopp, the Director of Privacy and Data Project for the Center for Democracy and Technology.
And we'll go to a printmaking workshop on Hawaii Island, and a young athlete gets ready for the Olympic trials.
In the meantime, you can call us anytime you like and leave us your comments at our talkback line, 808-792-8217. We do like to hear from you, especially when you leave comments in your own voice. But if you don't want to do that, you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And you can find us under Talk Shows for the Conversation under hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.